Hello and welcome back to our digital class on physical chemistry of polymers 2, now with its second lesson unit, viscoelasticity. The last lesson unit has given us an introduction to the field of rheology. What we do in this field is we attempt to answer the question, how does a material react upon application of stress? We have seen in the last lesson unit that there is basically two extremes. The first is purely elastic behavior, as conceptualized within the mechanical element of a spring and captured by Hooke's law. The other extreme is purely viscous behavior, as conceptualized by a mechanical element of a dashpot and mathematized in Newton's law. This is a black and white scheme. In the present lesson unit, we will see that there is many gray scales in between these extremes and regard them. These are particularly relevant for polymer systems. Actually, many materials often exhibit both elastic as well as viscous properties. Such materials are named viscoelastic. Strictly speaking, all matter exhibits this dualism, because depending on the timescale of observation, a material will either more display its viscous or its elastic characteristics. Consider window glass as an example. When you probe this by the application of stress on short timescales, like minutes or seconds, the material response is purely elastic. So on these short timescales, you would correctly denote glass to be an elastic solid. By contrast, if we would observe a glass window over the time of centuries or millennia, we would see a very slow but notable flow. On these long timescales, glass is a fluid. Little footnote in this context, some textbooks mention this example and refer to a proof by saying that old ornamental windows in cathedrals or very old churches are indeed thicker at the bottom than at the top, which, due to that line of argument, is due to the flow of the glass windows that has occurred over the timescales of centuries that these cathedrals have already witnessed. This is qualitatively correct, but not quantitatively. Even on the timescales of a few centuries, as the age of many old cathedrals is, there is flow of the glass windows, but not yet to a notable extent. The reason why these glass windows are thicker at the bottom than at the top is that in those times when they were manufactured upright, and so they exhibited flow during the period of cool down. Qualitatively, however, the very core of the argument is still correct. Indeed, the glass still flows, but with speeds that require even longer times to manifest themselves. Nevertheless, the core principle holds true. Generally, all materials can display flow if we just give them enough time. The Greek aphorism, pantarei, everything flows, is therefore not only correct in philosophy, but also in rheology. For polymer systems, this viscoelastic dual behavior is very pronounced, because the range where the one behavior transitions into the other lays on timescales of seconds or minutes, practically relevant, and both is covered by common normal timescale rheology experiments, and so the behavior of both is actually detected. As a result, the mechanical properties of polymers are versatile and rich, and this is what makes polymers prominent for many diverse applications. We have seen in our first lesson unit already two different types of how rheological experiments can be conducted: uniaxial strain and shear deformation. Today, we will see three other perspectives on how rheology experiments can be conducted, each of which with these two different deformation modes, by the way. So in total, it's actually 2 by 3, that means 6 different variants of rheological experiments that exist. The three that we distinguish in this present lesson unit is the relaxation experiment, the creep test, and the dynamic experiment. The relaxation experiment derives from the Latin relaxare, to relieve. In a relaxation experiment, we apply a condition of an external strain to a material and measure what the resulting stress in the material does as a function of time. This is shown to you in figure 65 of our script. In the case of an ideal elastic solid, we have seen already from Hooke's law that there is direct proportionality between stress and strain, with the proportionality factor elastic modulus. As a result of this direct proportionality, the blue graphical representation for the time-dependent strain and the green representation of the time-dependent stress in figure 65 show no visual difference. They have the same time course, but just differ in the absolute numbers, as captured by the constant of proportionality, the elastic modulus. In our time-dependent experiment, this quantity is also time-dependent, and so we refer to it as the time-dependent relaxation modulus. This is denoted to you in handwritten form underneath the dataset sketches for the elastic case in figure number 65. In the other extreme case of an ideal viscous fluid, according to Newton's law, stress in the material is not proportional to strain directly, but to its time dependence, that means to the rate of deformation. The time-dependent course of deformation given as the condition in figure 65 shows a steep ramp of the strain at the beginning of its application and at the end of its application. A According to Newton's law, the time derivative at these two ramp positions is infinity. So as a result, the green sketched representation of the time-dependent stress in the material, as sketched in the rightmost illustration of the bottom line of figure 65, shows two infinite spikes at the positions where the strain ramp is applied and released in the condition. The intermediate case of a viscoelastic material, initially upon application of strain, shows an initial elastic response, that means an initial abrupt buildup of stress in the material. After that, however, the viscous properties come into play and lead to a time-dependent relaxation of the stress in the material if the strain is kept at a constant level during that time. This is shown to you in the middle illustration of figure 65. In some samples, this stress goes back to zero. In others, it does not, but by contrast, leads to a permanent residual stress plateau in the sample. This is indicated by the dashed part of the line of the middle representation in figure 65. The plateau modulus is named equilibrium modulus and denotes the temporal limit of the time-dependent relaxation modulus. The second general type of rheological experiment is the creep test. Here, we do the inverse as in the relaxation experiment. As a condition, we now apply a time-dependent stress to the material and record the answer, the time-dependent resulting strain. Again, the condition that we apply is a ramp profile, as shown in the upper illustration of figure 66. Analogous to the relaxation experiment, in the case of an ideal elastic solid, there is direct proportionality of stress and strain according to Hooke's law, and so the blue sketched time-dependent answer profile directly resembles the green sketched time-dependent condition profile. In this arrangement of variables where strain is recorded as a function of stress, Hooke's law has an inverse notation compared to the one we have used before, and as such, also the concept of proportionality between these two variables in it is inverse. It is referred to as the creep compliance, denoted by the symbol J, which is the inverse of the elastic modulus. The other extreme of an ideal viscous fluid is mathematically characterized by Newton's law, in which stress is proportional to the rate of strain. In our condition of the creep test shown in figure 66, we apply a time constant stress. As this must be the derivative of strain, the time-dependent strain has to be a linearly increasing function, as shown in the rightmost illustration of the lower row in figure 66. What this tells us is that strain increases linearly as long as stress is kept at a constant level. This is what we refer to as creep of the material. When the applied stress is released, the material specimen does not snap back to its original shape, as it would do if it were an elastic solid, but by contrast resides in its deformed state, which it has achieved during the creep period. As such, we can conclude that viscous flow is irreversible. For the intermediate case of a viscoelastic material, we observe a mix of both characteristics. At the onset of application of stress, there is a certain instantaneous rise of the strain of the material also. This is the response of the elastic part of the material. With further proceeding of time, the strain proceeds further slowly, which is the viscous creep that then sets in. We can basically sub-distinguish two further subcases. If the material has more elastic than viscous properties, this creeping will lead to a final plateau. We refer to such a material as a viscoelastic solid. If, by contrast, the viscoelastic material has more liquid-like than solid-like appearance, there will be ongoing creep. We refer to this as a viscoelastic liquid. Whereas the two preceding types of experiments have applied a time-constant condition to the material, a third variant of experiment does so in a dynamic fashion. In a so-called dynamic experiment, we apply a sinusoidally modulated stress or a sinusoidally modulated strain to the material and record the time-dependent respective other property in either case. Figure 67 in our script shows the case where a sinusoidally modulated time-dependent stress is applied and the corresponding modulated time-dependent response in strain is recorded. In a classical lecture hall setting of this class, at this point I usually give an exercise to the audience. In this case on the blackboard, I only show the green curve of figure 67, the sinusoidally modulated stress, and ask the audience, what would you think how would the answer function, the strain, look like? After some thinking together, we can develop the answer. We know that in the case of a purely elastic ideal solid, according to Hooke's law, stress and strain are proportional to each other. That means the time-dependent strain, alternatively also shear deformation, will also be a sinus function. That means in phase with the one of the stress. By contrast, in the case of a purely viscous ideal liquid, we know that according to Newton's law, stress is the time derivative of strain. And that means if strain is a sine, then stress is a cosine. In the experimental situation that we consider in figure 67, these two variables are the other way around. We apply stress and record strain. That means if we apply stress in the form of a sine wave, strain has to be the antiderivative, in German Stammfunktion, of stress, which is a minus cosine wave. In either constellation, however, stress and strain are 90 degrees out of phase. That means there is a phase angle between them, which is 90 degrees, or pi half if you like that better. As viscoelastic materials are something in between these two extremes, we can guess already that for a viscoelastic material, the response function will also be a sine wave exhibiting a phase shift between these two extremes. That means between 0 and 90 degrees. We can also express this as between 0 and pi half, depending on what measure of the phase angle you prefer. That means we can write the answer function like it is done in the blue handwritten form in figure 67. It is a wave curve exhibiting a phase angle that shifts it from the green denoted stress wave curve. The phase angle is 0 for an elastic solid, it's 90 degrees or pi half for a viscous liquid, and it is something in between for a viscoelastic material. The notion of the two functions in figure 67 is done in a complex number notation. The reason is, as we'll see in a minute, the constants of proportionality between stress and strain, which are the elastic modulus or viscosity, will turn out to be complex numbers in such a dynamic experiment. We remember from our first lesson unit, in Hooke's law, the elastic modulus is the constant of proportionality between stress and strain. That means the elastic modulus is the ratio of stress to strain. In a dynamic experiment, if we take the two notations for stress and strain, the green and the blue written ones, and calculate this ratio, it turns out that the elastic modulus is a complex number, as denoted to you in equation 5.7a in our script. For the very related variant of shear deformation, the result is also a complex number, the complex shear modulus, as denoted in equation 5.7b in our script. With Euler's formula, these equations, which feature an exponential form of an imaginary argument, can be split into a real and an imaginary part, as denoted to you in equations 5.8a and 5.8b in our script. The two parts of these moduli, the real and the imaginary, are named storage modulus and loss modulus. The real part, the storage modulus, captures the elastic properties of our sample, whereas the imaginary part, the loss modulus, captures the viscous characteristics of our sample. We can read out these two parts directly from the equation pair 5.8, which gives us the equation pairs 5.9 and 5.10. We can see from this that the extent of the real and the imaginary parts to the modulus, that means the extent of the storage and the loss capabilities of our material, depend on the phase angle. If the phase angle is zero, that means if we deal with an ideal elastic solid, the imaginary parts E double prime and G double prime are zero. And that means only the elastic parts E prime or G prime make up the complex modulus E star or G star. By contrast, in an ideal viscous sample with a phase angle of pi half or 90 degrees, it's just the other way around. Then the real parts E prime and G prime are zero. So the viscous parts, the imaginary ones, E double prime and G double prime, make up the whole complex modulus E star or G star. In an intermediate case of a viscoelastic material, both parts contribute to the complex moduli. And here, depending on the phase angle, either the one or the other part dominates the complex modulus. The extent of domination of these storage or loss modulus contributions to the complex moduli E star or G star can be judged from their ratio. That means E double prime over E prime or G double prime over G prime. According to a simple trigonometric evaluation, which is shown in figure 68 of our script, these ratios can simply be described as the tangent of the loss angle delta. This quantity is therefore referred to as the loss tangent. If tangent delta is greater than 1, that means in the ratio of E double prime over E prime or G double prime over G prime, the numerator dominates over the denominator. In other words, the value of the loss modulus, which is the one in the numerator, is greater than the value of the storage modulus, which is the one in the denominator. For the material properties, this means that the imaginary part is more important than the real part. So the viscous parts of the mechanical properties dominate, and we have a viscoelastic liquid. By contrast, if tangent delta is smaller than 1, then it's just the other way around. The value of the storage modulus in the denominator of the ratio of E double prime over E prime or G double prime over G prime is greater than the value of the loss modulus in the numerator of these ratios. That means the elastic parts of the sample dominate, and we have a viscoelastic solid. In the case right in the middle, tangent delta being 1, the elastic and viscous parts contribute equally. So far, we have a quite mathematical understanding of the moduli. Can we also give this some practical illustration? Yes, of course we can. Consider a simple thing like a rubbery bounce ball, which is dropped by a person from a certain definite height, like the height of the arm of this person. This rubbery bounce ball will hit the ground and bounce back and shoot back up, but it won't reach the same height as it has had before. The reason is not friction by air, but dissipation of some of the energy during the bounce. The part of the height that is gained back by the bounce is reflected by the energy storage that has been stored and relieved into a reverse motion during the bounce. This part, therefore, corresponds to the storage modulus, whereas the other part, which is lost, corresponds to the loss modulus. This example gives us a macroscopic illustration of what the storage and the loss modulus is. Can we also connect this to a microscopic picture of the material internal structure? This is what we seek for in this lecture, the structure-property relation. Yes, we can. This will be delivered to you in a later lesson unit. I can foretake already the bottom line. A bouncy ball made of rubber is constituted out of a polymer network. On nanoscopic scales, this polymer network has a mesh structure. And the tightness of these meshes determine the elastic modulus. As upon deformation, the deformation energy is stored in stretched polymer network strands microscopically. Dissipation of energy happens by structural features that are part of the network but not capable of getting stretched and therefore storing deformation energy. Structural features like that are loose dangling chains connected to the network with only one extremity. We will conceptualize this in a lot more detail in a later lesson unit. And there we will see how the microstructural features in the material directly translate into a material property, which is the elastic modulus. And here in the example of figure 69, we see how this further translates into behavior, that means into function. This chain of conceptual insight, how chemical structure translates into physical parameters and how those translates into function, is exactly what will be on your everyday agenda in your later profession as developing chemists in the chemical industries. Customers will approach you not with the intent to get a certain chemical structure from you, but with the intent to get a function. What you have to do, therefore, is to reverse the line of thought that we have just considered. You have to translate the desired function into a measurable physical parameter and then translate this into a chemical structure that will deliver it. The latter example specifically target elastic properties. Let's also have a regard on the viscous properties. In fact, by a dynamic experiment, we can not only determine a complex elastic modulus, but also the inverse of it, which is the complex creep compliance. And as we will see in a minute, in view of Newton's law, we can also determine a complex viscosity. We know that the creep compliance is just the reciprocal of the elastic modulus. That means the complex creep compliance, which we refer to as J star, is just the reciprocal of the complex modulus, 1 over E star or 1 over G star. It is the ratio not of stress and strain, but of strain and stress. For the case of oscillatory deformation, for example in a shear scenario, this quantity calculates as denoted in equation 512a in our script. By expanding this complex number through a little mathematical trick, we get to the form expressed in equation 5.12b in our script. Here we see that the complex creep compliance, just like the complex moduli, consists of two parts, a real and an imaginary one, which are just the inverse of the corresponding parts of the modulus. In an analogous fashion, we can also calculate the complex viscosity. Let's consider again a dynamic oscillatory shear deformation case and calculate the viscosity as denoted in equation 513a of our script. Some further transformation over the intermediate step of equation 513b leads us to the form of equation 513c. Once more, we see that this quantity is composed of a real and an imaginary part. Note the delicate difference to the creep compliance though. Here, the real part of the viscosity has to do with the imaginary part of the modulus, and vice versa. The imaginary part of the viscosity has to do with the real part of the modulus. This is because the meaning of viscosity and modulus are just opposite. Whereas viscosity denotes energy dissipation, the modulus denotes energy storage. And so the real part of the dissipation quantity corresponds to the imaginary part of the storage quantity, and vice versa. When we regard this quantity specifically for polymer systems, that means polymer solutions or polymer melts, we have to make ourselves clear that it is a lot different as what we know from classical solutions or melts of small molecules. In this context, in the setting of a classical lecture hall realization of this class, I usually ask a student to draw a so-called flow curve. A flow curve is a graphical plot of stress on the y-axis over strain on the x-axis. How would such a curve look like where you represent stress as a function of strain rate, or shear rate if it's a shear experiment? The solution is simple. According to Newton's law, this has to be a straight line passing through the origin, as stress is proportional to shear or strain rate, with a constant of proportionality, which is the viscosity. According to the perfect match of this flow behavior to Newton's law, it is referred to as Newtonian flow. Polymer solutions and melts, by contrast, often show deviations from this ideal behavior, which we refer to as non-Newtonian flow. We can basically distinguish two scenarios, shear thinning and shear thickening, both represented in figure 70a of our script. Shear thinning is very important for polymer systems. In this scenario, viscosity decreases as the shear rate increases. The microscopic picture behind this is that the application of a shear force destroys possible aggregate structures in our sample, and if it's chain molecules that constitute it, orients the chains along the direction of flow, thereby facilitating their displacement and thereby enabling easier flow of the liquid. Such shear thinning behavior is actually often wanted when soft materials shall flow under force but stay solid at rest. A very famous example is if you want to put paint on the wall. You want the paint to be easily applicable as long as you exert shear forces by brushing it, but as soon as you stop brushing it, you want to stay it in place and not show drips. And so paints are purposely engineered to display shear thinning. Other examples are butter on toast or toothpaste. These are also materials that you want to exhibit flow as long as you apply force, for example, with a knife when you spread the butter on your toast, or as long as you squeeze the toothpaste tube. But as soon as you stop spreading the butter on your toast with a knife or squeezing the toothpaste out of its tube, you want these materials to no longer flow. There is another example in which shear thinning turns out to be beneficial, and this is one which is right from the core of the polymer engineering discipline. Polymer materials are often processed by a process named extrusion. In this process, polymer melts are squeezed through thin nozzles. As we have just seen during that squeezing, they exhibit a change of the microscopic structure such that chains are oriented and extended into the direction of flow. And if such a melt is then cooled down and solidified, for example, in the context of extruding a foil, the polymers are locked in this non-equilibrium conformation. This can be utilized for applications, for example, in so-called shrink foils that can be used to enwrap foodstuff. If such shrink foils are heated, the polymer chains that are trapped in an unnatural conformation inside of them can relax into their original coiled conformation, which comes along with a decrease in volume. And as such, the whole foil shrinks and can thereby serve for airtight packaging of goods. In 1925, Ostwald referred to shear thinning as structural viscosity, because in that case, a sample changes its microscopic structure, as we have just illustrated for the example of polymer chains in shrink foils. As a little add-on, the unnatural orientation of the chains in the shrink foils after the extrusion process also manifests itself such that such foils cause light polarization. As useful as shear thinning is for applications, it poses a challenge for research scientists. If we want to probe the viscosity of a polymer sample, we have to make ourselves clear that it depends on the rate of deformation, which we have to apply at some finite value to the sample. What is done to take this into account is that we probe the sample at many different shear rates and extrapolate the resulting viscosity to a shear rate of zero. We refer to this as the zero shear viscosity, eta zero, in which limit the shear thinning curve in figure 70a approaches the Newtonian line. A variant of shear thinning is materials referred to as Bingham fluids, as shown by the uppermost graph in figure 70b of our script. These materials exhibit a certain flow threshold at a specific yield stress. That means they act like a solid at zero or very low shear or strain, but above a certain threshold, they start to flow like a Newtonian fluid. The microscopic reason for this is that there is a certain minimal stress in the material necessary to break certain aggregate structures mediated by interactions in the material, such as van der Waals forces or hydrogen bonds. Examples are again toothpaste or mayonnaise or ketchup. You may all know this famous experiment where you shake a bottle of ketchup too heavily and spill the ketchup all over your plate. A variant of this is the Casson fluid, which acts like a Bingham fluid, but then furthermore exhibits shear thinning. The opposite deviation from pure Newtonian flow is shear thickening. In this case, the viscosity of the sample increases at increasing shear or strain rate. The microstructural explanation for this is a little more complicated. It assumes the existence of transient hydrodynamic clusters of the particles or molecules inside the fluid. These can spontaneously form and break in the material. At high shear rates, however, the shear oscillation period gets shorter than the lifetime of these clusters, and this means on the timescale of one shear period, they have an infinite lifetime, thereby imparting great hindrance on the flow during that cycle. An example for this behavior is a wet suspension of water and sand. Maybe you have made the following experiment already during holidays at the beachside. If you stand at a beach, you can bury your feet into wet sand if you slowly dig into it. If you then try to abruptly pull out the foot of the wet sand, it is stuck. The reason is exactly this. At low deformation rate, which you apply by slowly digging your feet into the wet sand suspension, the viscosity of this suspension is low. At high deformation rate, which you apply when abruptly trying to take your foot out, the viscosity of that suspension is very high, prohibiting your foot to escape. Just for the sake of completeness, there is two further variants of complex rheological behaviors. These are thixotropy and rheopaxy, both denoting time-dependent behavior. In thixotropy, the viscosity decreases over time, whereas in the context of rheopaxy, the viscosity increases over time. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. We have learned about three fundamental types of how to probe materials in rheological experiments. The most important one is the dynamic experiment, because this delivers us frequency and thereby also time-dependent properties. A central outcome of our consideration of dynamic experiments in this lesson unit was that the central quantities that we discuss in the realm of rheology, the elastic moduli or their inverse, the creep compliance, and the viscosity, turn out to be complex numbers. This may appear frightening to us at a first view, but it is actually very insightful, because with that, these quantities reflect both the ability to store and to dissipate external deformation energy of materials. And as we have indicated already several times, this is particularly relevant and pronounced for polymer materials. In the mid and second half of the 20th century, the French physicist Pierre-Gilles Digène recognized striking universality of the rheological behavior of polymer materials and other materials that are built out of colloidal scale building blocks, such as amphiphilic self-assemblies or hard sphere colloidal particles, and summarized these materials under a new class named soft matter. This consideration enabled fundamentally new insights into physics as representatives of soft matter, due to the large size and thereby also slowness of motion of its building blocks, is easy to observe. But the basic physics behind phase transitions and ordering phenomena are the same as in classical materials. This was awarded with a Nobel Prize in Physics in 1991. And in his Nobel Prize speech, Pierre-Gilles Digène opened with the words, "What do we mean by soft matter? Americans prefer to call it complex fluids. This is a rather ugly name, which tends to discourage the young students. We have learned about the complex nature of the fundamental material properties today, which is one of the reasons why scientists, specifically from the Anglo-American regions, refer to these as complex fluids." Digène expressed his disfavoring of that term and rather introduced the term soft matter for it. As just said, a reason that he named for that was that the term complex has a risk of frightening off or discouraging students. I hope that you don't feel discouraged by the complex nature of mechanical properties, but instead recognize the potential deep and general insight that can emerge from that.